I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. The brutal attack this week on a school in Peshawar, Pakistan, that killed over 130 people, most of them students, has outraged the world. It's the worst terror attack in the country's history, and the descriptions of the massacre are gruesome and chilling. Pakistan's Taliban has claimed responsibility, saying it was retaliating for the government's assault on its havens in North Waziristan. Joining us to talk about the situation in Pakistan is Michael Kugelman. He's a senior program associate for South and Southeast Asia at the Woodrow Wilson Center, where his work focuses on national security. He joins us from their studios. And Michael Kugelman, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Nice to have you here. And to be perfectly honest with you, I'm just trying to wrap my brain around why the Taliban would target school children. Of course, we know a couple of years ago they targeted Malala Yousafzai, who just won the Nobel Peace Prize. They have targeted children before. But why school children?
Well, as you say, the Pakistani Taliban and other militant groups in Pakistan repeatedly go after children. And I think we have to keep in mind that the Pakistani Taliban is leading an insurgency against the Pakistani state. But these are not really insurgents. They're psychopaths. They're criminals. They're sadists. They don't care about such things. They're happy to kill kids. And I think in this particular attack, certainly they were going after a school. They were going after kids. But above all, they were trying to send a strong message to the army. And this was an army-run school. They wanted to send a message to the Pakistani army that not only is the army not safe from Taliban attacks, but the army's children, the military's children, the next generation, are not safe either. And it sends a very powerful and really a very terrifying message as well.
Who are the Pakistani Taliban? And you've written about sort of their evolution, offshoot from this and offshoot from that. I guess we can go back a couple of decades to the start.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Pakistani Taliban and the Afghan Taliban and various other militant groups in Pakistan and Afghanistan really all descend from the Mujahideen fighters that were nurtured by the Pakistanis with support from the United States and the Saudis that went after the Soviets when they were occupying Afghanistan. But essentially, after the September 11th attacks, Pakistan decided to side with the United States. It decided to become closer to the United States. And a lot of these Mujahideen fighters turned against the Pakistani state. And among those fighters that turned against the Pakistani state were those that later formed the Pakistani Taliban. It wasn't until 2007 when it became a formal group. But ever since then, it has been fighting this incredibly violent insurgency against the Pakistani state. Has its havens in the tribal areas, particularly North Waziristan, but it really has spread beyond the tribal areas. The Pakistani Taliban has a very significant presence in Peshawar, where this attack was on Tuesday, but also in other major cities, including Karachi, the financial capital.
And what do they want? Do they want to run or rule Pakistan?
Yes. I mean, they essentially want to turn Pakistan into what Afghanistan was in the 1990s. They want to overthrow the government. They want to overthrow, really destroy the state and all of its institutions and replace it with a hardline Islamist system in which the most virulently hardline interpretations of Sharia law are imposed. So again, they want to replicate what the Afghan Taliban had put in place in Afghanistan during the 90s.
You have written, others have written, and they get their money in part from the drug trade. Help us understand, you know, why an organization that wants to impose a strict definition of Islam and Sharia law would be funding itself selling drugs. That just doesn't compute for me anyway.
Well, you're right. This is one of the many contradictions and hypocrisies about groups like the Taliban. But I think that it's important to emphasize that, yes, they do get funding from the drug trade, both the Pakistani Taliban and the Afghan Taliban. But that's only one of many funding sources. There are all kinds. The Taliban depends on a lot of different illicit trade, and not all of it along the lines of drugs. Timber, for example, is a huge thing for the Pakistani Taliban. They've made a lot of money by chopping down trees and selling timber illegally. They also get a lot of their funding and their money from abductions and things like that, extortions, ransoms, So, you know, the drug trade is important, but I would argue that they really diversify when it comes to their funding sources, even more so than the Afghan Taliban, which really is heavily dependent on the drug trade.
How much support is there any way to know how much support there is for the Taliban in Pakistan, especially after an assault such as this?
Well, I would argue that Pakistan, as you know, is a very radicalized society. You have very powerful, influential people, religious leaders, and quite frankly, even popular TV anchors, news anchors, that have very hardline views and wouldn't actually outright say that they support what the Taliban does. But these are individuals that generally won't condemn the Taliban when it commits attacks like these. But I would not say that the population on the whole is pro-Taliban. Certainly there are exceptions. It's a radicalized society. But I think increasingly, as the Taliban in Pakistan has resorted to attacks that go after civilians, there's been much more of a focus on civilian targets in the last year or two. I think that's really turned the population away from the Taliban.
In fact, Michael, we have an email from Beverly from Delaware. She says, I was a part of a Delaware delegation to Pakistan for 10 days last January. She says, most of my Pakistani Facebook friends now have solid black as their faces on their Facebook pages. What I hear most often from them is heartbroken. That's in quotations. Their pain is immense and they're holding their children close.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, this is the Pakistani Twitter users have also changed their avatars to black space. This is happening a lot. And I think what's also particularly significant is that in Islamabad, the capital of Pakistan, the major mosque there, it's called the Red Mosque, the head cleric there is a radical. He is essentially a pro-Taliban guy. He went on Pakistani TV, as many of these hardline Islamists do, and he refused to condemn the Peshawar attack.
Wow.
Now, in the past, nothing would come of that. No one would really do anything or say anything. But in this case, over the last few days, a relatively modest but nonetheless noisy crowd has gathered outside of that mosque and called for him to be arrested. And that's a huge calling for him to be arrested because of the fact that he seems to be sympathizing with these Taliban militants. That's huge. And I think it shows that the population really is, on the whole, a peace-loving population, despite how the tentacles of radicalization have really spread across that country's society.
I mean, could we say this might be a turning point? It's not like the first time there's been a terrorist attack in Pakistan, but could this be a turning point?
I mean, that's a good question. It could be in terms of public responses. I'm just seeing in terms of people I'm talking to on the ground and what I'm seeing on social media, just more of a galvanizing element than is typical. I mean, typically when these things happen, you know, there's outrage, there's condemnations, but people move on. But I think that this seems to be different. But the question is if it'll be a turning point in terms of policy and in terms of what the government and the military do. And there, unfortunately, I'm just a bit more cynical because, as you know, for many years, the Pakistani state has tended to distinguish between what it thinks of as good and bad militants. Militants like the Pakistani Taliban that target the Pakistani state are thought of as bad militants and that the state feels it should go after. But then there are militant groups like the Afghan Taliban, the Haqqani Network, groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba. These are groups that are based in Pakistan but do not target the Pakistani state. And the Pakistani state has never felt the need to go after them. And the fact that this attack in Peshawar was carried out by the Pakistani Taliban, I think will only solidify that view held within the Pakistani security establishment that it's these anti-state groups that are the bad militants and that deserve attention. Even though these quote-unquote good militants, you know, they have the same ideologies as the Pakistani Taliban. They've worked with them. They've carried out attacks with them outside of Pakistan. But I think that for that reason, unfortunately, we won't necessarily see a sea change in how the Pakistani state regards militancy and what to do about it.
My understanding is the Pakistani Taliban did this in revenge for the military targeting of Taliban in North Waziristan. Yes?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, that was the explicitly stated reason that the Taliban spokesperson gave. And again, I mean, this was a school that is run by the military. So, yeah, that's the stated goal. But one could also argue that they were trying to send a message that, you know, they still have the ability to inflict fear and damage in the population, because that military offensive that you referred to, it was launched in June in North Waziristan, and I think it has caused some damage to the Pakistani Taliban. And this comes after several years of drone strikes having had a significant impact on the Pakistani Taliban. Two recent supreme leaders of the Pakistani Taliban were killed in drone strikes. The Pakistani army has been leading operations against the Pakistani Taliban for a number of years. So I think the Taliban wanted to show that it's still relevant and that it can still instill fear in the population. And it certainly did that with this horrific attack.
So do you anticipate the government increasing those attacks in response to what happened this week?
Yes. I mean, the military has said that it's going to intensify its campaign. And in fact, this has already happened. Just in the last day or so, there have been a large number of Pakistani airstrikes in the tribal areas meant to go after some of the groups seen as some of the individuals or members of the groups responsible for this attack. Now, the problem with that is that the Pakistani military is not known for being careful about civilian casualties when it's engaging in military operations. I think we're going to have to worry. I mean, perhaps on a tactical level, it's good that more bad guys, more Taliban will be targeted. But invariably, this could cause more IDP, refugee situations. It could cause more civilian casualties. And also, it could trigger more retaliatory attacks from the Taliban. So we could be entering yet another cycle of violence in this country that has experienced so much of it.
Do you think the Taliban can be defeated militarily?
No, 200% sure that the answer is no right there. I mean, you can kill all the militants you want with force, but you're not going to remove the group unless you do, in my view, two things. One is to go after the sources of financing, which we talked about before. Mm-hmm. You know, some of them are easier to go after than others. It's hard to go after the drug or the timber trade. But I think there are a lot of indications that the Pakistani Taliban and the Afghan Taliban gets funding from certain parts of the world, certain countries in the Gulf that already have an ideological presence, so to speak, in Pakistan. They fund madrasas, for example. Something needs to be done about that. Won't be easy because Pakistan very much values its relationships with countries like Saudi Arabia and other countries like that. Second thing that has to be done is the government and it really needs to develop a counter-narrative to these extremist ideologies that are so powerful and pronounced in Pakistan. As I said before, you have these very popular TV channels that everyone watches in the country that have these superstar anchors, news anchors that propagate these types of views. You have very influential religious leaders that propagate these views. The government doesn't respond, and I think it needs to, with help from civil society.
And I want to pick up on that after this very short break, talking with Michael Kugelman about Pakistan, about the terror attack earlier this week that killed more than 130 people, most of them children, school students. He's Senior Program Associate for South and Southeast Asia at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Any questions or comments, call us 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. In this hour of the show, we're focusing on two important news stories this week. In just a couple of minutes, we'll be talking about President Obama's announcement on Wednesday that the U.S. was going to begin normalizing relations with Cuba. But before then, we continue our conversation with Michael Kugelman. We are talking about Pakistan, the attack on the school earlier this year, and the various challenges that face that country. And again, to join our conversation, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Michael, you talked about the government, the Pakistani government, developing a counter-narrative to some of these more extremist narratives that have such a big audience. What would that narrative sound like?
Well, I think it would have to be a narrative that, above all, says that there is absolutely no justification or legitimacy for the use of violence against civilians or for any sort of purpose, whether supposedly in the name of Islam or whatever the case may be. That certainly is the first, and I would argue the most important step that needs to be taken. And I think also there's a tendency with these extremist ideologies, which really percolate down to many in the middle class and even in the upper class, that to really attribute all of Pakistan's problems to other countries, really to blame India, to blame the United States, to blame others, other countries for everything that ails Pakistan. And as you may have heard, a very prominent anti-India militant named Hafiz Saeed, based in Pakistan, he essentially came out and said that India launched the attacks on the school in Peshawar, and he said he was going to threaten to attack India for that.
Wow.
And a number of people have agreed with him. Now, certainly this does not represent mainstream points of view, but there is a lot of sympathy for that type of thing. Where's the government coming out to say, no, that's absolutely false?
And why don't they say that?
Well,
I mean, it seems like it goes without saying that you don't do this to your people.
Right. Well, I mean, the government has come out and said that the Taliban did this, but it has not responded directly to what Hafiz Saeed has said. And that's because of who Hafiz Saeed is. He's the commander or the leader of the Lashkar-e-Taiba terror group, which, among other things, carried out the terrorist attacks in Mumbai in India in 2008. This is a group that has a long relationship with the Pakistani security establishment, particularly the intelligence agency, because it is seen as an asset, as a tool to weaken India, which, of course, is Pakistan's enemy. And in Pakistan, it's really the military and the security establishment that is the most powerful institution in the country. And if it wants to have these types of relationships, it will unfortunately have them, despite any misgivings or disagreements from the government in that regard.
Do you see Pakistan as, if not the, one of the most dangerous countries in the world?
It's certainly a dangerous country, but I would not, and it depends how you define dangerous. I mean, if you look at number of homicides per X number of people, the answer is definitely no. It is a dangerous country because it has so many different militant groups, because the security establishment has relationships with a number of these militant groups, and also, of course, above all, because Pakistan has nuclear weapons, which you can't say for a number of other countries that have this militancy problem. But I think it's important to keep in mind, I mean, anyone that goes to Pakistan, including myself, when you're there, you will find that it's not as crazy and unstable and terrifying as some folks make it out to be, and particularly in urban areas, there definitely are no-go areas. But it is not; it's a country that is not failing. There are institutions that work very well, the army being one of them, alas. So I would argue that it's not; it certainly is not the most dangerous country in the world, but it belongs up there for the combination of reasons that I mentioned.
And how would you describe the relationship between Pakistan and the United States? I mean, some have said, you know, use the word frenemies, both sort of friend and enemy at the same time.
That's exactly what it is, because the United States has oftentimes seen Pakistan as a country that can be very helpful, that can help the United States pursue and achieve its interests. And most recently, that involves the Afghanistan war. The United States has really tried to get closer to Pakistan over the last few years in the hopes that Pakistan would work with the United States to deal with challenges in Afghanistan. Of course, that hasn't worked out very well in my view. I mean, the bottom line is that Pakistan, its security establishment has relationships, has sponsored militant groups that pose a direct threat to the United States, such as the Afghan Taliban. They've killed American troops, the Haqqani Network, which has killed American troops. And for that reason alone, it's hard to say that this is anything beyond a dysfunctional relationship. Though that said, the interesting thing is that relations have improved significantly in the last few years. I think both sides have really decided they want to try to make things work. I mean, quite frankly, the Pakistanis value the money and the arms, particularly the military aid that it gets from the United States. And the United States wants to continue to have Pakistan on its side because, quite frankly, the alternative of having an unstable, violent, nuclear-armed country not on your side is it's dangerous thought.
And a final question to you. When the U.S. Actually leaves, I know there are a number of troops, I guess, will be there, but a much smaller number than has been there over the last decade or so. But when the U.S. presence is much smaller in Afghanistan, will that have an impact on Pakistan, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think it will. I mean, if you assume, as I do, that security will deteriorate in Afghanistan after most foreign troops leave at the end of this month, that will have a direct impact on Pakistan just because it's a bordering country. Pakistan and Afghanistan share an extremely unstable, unguarded border where you have militants crossing from one side to the other all the time. That said, the fact that there will continue to be some presence of U.S. military in Pakistan after this year, in Afghanistan, after this year, including a small combat presence, that I think increases the chances that drone strikes will continue in Pakistan. And as you know, these have always been unpopular among many segments of the population. The government and the military behind the scenes, I think, sign off on them, but think that the drone issue, which has always been a tension point between the U.S. and Pakistan, will certainly continue. Though I don't think there will be as many drone strikes as there had been because so much of the military presence will be gone from Afghanistan, but it'll continue, and I think for that reason, drones will be one more reason why the U.S. and Pakistan will be destined to have a rather prickly, difficult relationship.
Well, Michael Kugelman, I thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times, talking about this very important issue. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And he's Senior Program Associate for South and Southeast Asia at the Woodrow Wilson Center. His work focuses on national security issues, particularly in Southeast Asia. And he joined us on Radio Times. He wanted to get his response to the attack earlier this week in Peshawar, Pakistan, over more than 130 people killed, and mostly students, and sort of where that leaves that country. Well, earlier this week, President Obama surprised a lot of people when he announced that the United States was reestablishing diplomatic relations with Cuba. And here's how he began his announcement.
Today, the United States of America is changing its relationship with the people of Cuba. In the most significant changes in our policy in more than 50 years, we will end an outdated approach that for decades has failed to advance our interests, and instead, we will begin to normalize relations between our two countries. Through these changes, we intend to create more opportunities for the American and Cuban people and begin a new chapter among the nations of the Americas.
For more than 50 years since the Cuban Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba have been enemies. But while that has been the public stance, privately, the Cuban government and successive U.S. presidents have been in contact on a range of issues. Our guest, Peter Kornbluh, is the co-author of a new book about the hidden negotiations between the two countries. It's called Back Channel to Cuba, and it's based on formerly secret documents and interviews. He's director of the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archives in Washington, D.C. And Peter Kornbluh, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, it's just great to be here in this momentous week of change in U.S.-Cuban relations.
Indeed it is. And based on your book and even the amount of reporting that you've done on this, was it a surprise what Obama said on Wednesday?
Well, you know, rumors have been swirling in Washington for quite some time that the Obama administration was going to change policy towards Cuba. But, of course, over the course of the history of U.S.-Cuban relations, we've heard some of these rumors before. And I really think we have to give President Obama and his team tremendous credit for two things. One, going before the American public, as the president did on television on Wednesday, and saying, we have had a policy that has failed. I mean, how many presidents can you remember ever publicly saying that to the American public? And then the second credit he gets is, and I'm going to change it to a policy that has much more likelihood of succeeding and is much more sensible in the modern age. And so he has taken Cuba out of the kind of dinosauric Cold War era of policy and finally brought it into the 21st century. And he deserves a lot of credit for that. Yes, I was in Cuba, actually, on Wednesday when this announcement came down, both the president speaking and the president of Cuba speaking simultaneously on the television, essentially. A lot of people were surprised. And I have to admit that the breadth of Obama's initiative and the language that he used of reconciliation was certainly a significant surprise to me.
I thought it was interesting the sort of under, perhaps sort of like your book, the role that Pope Francis played in the thawing relation between these two countries.
You know, we've had a situation over these last 55 years where, because of the political sensitivity of U.S.-Cuban relations, presidents have not seemed to feel that they could just talk openly to Cuba about changing their relationship in particular. And so you've had a succession of presidents who have gone to the back channel. They've used secret intermediaries. They've used third country governments, just like Obama did, to actually sit down, talk to the Cubans, work out deals, or attempt to work out deals, and in this case, successfully. And Pope Francis is the newest and the latest, and hopefully, in my opinion, the last of the secret intermediaries that were needed to make this happen. But there's a kind of a cast of characters that include Nobel Prize-winning author Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who ferried messages back and forth from Fidel Castro to Bill Clinton, the chairman of the board of Coca-Cola Company, who carried messages, very sensitive messages, from President Jimmy Carter down to Fidel Castro in the late 1970s, and even former President Jimmy Carter himself, who was enlisted to be an intermediary between Cuba and the United States to resolve the immigration crisis of 1994, known as the Balsero crisis. So you have a long list of these people, many more than I've just named, over the course of the last 50 years, and Pope Francis is the latest, I hope the last.
Well, and I do want to get to some of those presidents and some of the negotiations that went on, but I'm looking at a picture of you and Alan Gross. You interviewed him two times while he was in prison in Cuba. Here he is with a sign that says, "Hi, Mom." He looks very thin, I have to say. He was obviously jubilant, having been released from a Cuban prison after having been in prison for something like 5 years. First of all, was it hard for you to get into a prison to talk to him?
I didn't really go to interview him per se. I went to visit him, and I went twice over the course of a year. I got permission from the Cuban government directly to go in and meet with him. We spent a total of 7 hours together. We talked about what had happened to him. We talked about what he hoped would happen. We talked a lot about his mom and his family. And I just want to say, you know, I'm happy for his family and for him that he has come home. It was kind of the Obama administration's Hanukkah present to him that he was released on the first day of Hanukkah to rejoin his family after 5 years. His case is obviously been very contentious. There's been a lot of disinformation and misinformation around what he was doing in Cuba, as well as what was happening to him in prison in Cuba. But the bottom line is that his imprisonment in Cuba created major political obstacles for the Obama administration to move forward with something that I think the president has wanted to do for a long time: change the policy towards Cuba, advance U.S. interests, national interests, and international interests by adopting a modern 21st century approach to U.S.-Cuban relations.
Well, as you indicated, and what your book is about is all these secret private negotiations that have gone on for more than 50 years between these two countries, which makes you sort of wonder, so what were these public pronouncements about, and just how private and just how secret did these negotiations have to be? For instance, did the National Security Agency know that the U.S. was meeting with Cuban officials?
I can tell you from exploring some of the similar talks that went on 20 years ago and 30 years ago that even presidents of the United States would take pains to circumvent the National Security Agency. At one point, there were secret talks going on in 1995, and the people participating in them were told not to use their phones, both the Cubans and the Americans involved, so that the National Security Agency couldn't pick up any of these communications. So our own government was trying to hide these talks from other agencies in our government to make sure that they succeeded. And, you know, we didn't arrive at this past Wednesday with the announcement by President Obama of a new approach to Cuba without over a year of very extensive talks. The Pope playing the role of an intermediary, hosting meetings. The Pope, as you know, met with President Obama last spring. And even though we don't have the secret memorandum of conversation of what they talked about, I'm sure that Cuba was on the agenda. And we had the government of Canada hosting secret meetings, which they've done before over the last 50 years, helping the two parties come together and have the talks that were needed. And I think in the end, when we write the epilogue to our book, which we're going to do for the paperback edition now, I think we'll find out there were other countries and other people involved in bringing these messages back and forth and arriving at this grand bargain, this big deal, this arrangement, this new future for U.S.-Cuban relations.
And we're almost up on a break here, but did the Soviet Union, during the Cold War, was the Soviet Union aware that Cuban officials were meeting with the United States?
I think that Castro actually at times did tell the Soviet Union that he was doing this and that the Soviets actually approved. They didn't want Cuba to remain a Cold War, you know, hotspot for them and difficulty in their relationship with the United States. And so they were supportive at times. And at the very end of the Soviet Union, the Soviet government actually played an intermediary role, carrying messages from Fidel Castro, Russian officials, to the first Bush administration, Secretary of State James Baker, and to George H.W. Bush himself, saying that Castro was quite interested in better relations.
That's Peter Kornbluh, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, co-author of a new book that's called Back Channel to Cuba, subtitled The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana. Those negotiations are going on while very public pronouncements about each other, or the countries certainly describing each other as enemies, but nonetheless, these private negotiations going on behind the scenes. And Peter Kornbluh is a director of the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archives in Washington, D.C. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. I do want to talk about the role that Henry Kissinger played, and we do want to take calls at 1-888-477-9499. What do you think about this change policy? Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe. We're talking about President Obama's surprising announcement on Wednesday that the U.S. was going to restore diplomatic relations with Cuba. We've been talking a bit about the new policy, the secret negotiations leading up to it, and those secret negotiations have been in effect as long as the embargo has been in effect, and what it will mean for Americans and for Cubans as well. Peter Kornbluh, our guest, and again, you can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Peter, the section on Henry Kissinger wanting to normalize, I guess to some degree, relations with Cuba, this was under President Ford. Was he hoping to do with Cuba what Nixon had done with China?
He was. Henry Kissinger was the architect in many ways of a detente with China to try and empower the United States in its relationship with the Soviet Union. And, of course, the Chinese also wanted to play the U.S. card against the Soviet Union. But Kissinger believed that if he could have a detente with those major countries, he could certainly have a detente in the Caribbean with Cuba. And in some ways, he faced a very similar situation to what Barack Obama faced. Kissinger was facing a mutiny from the Latin American nations who were all under a multilateral sanctions accord at the OAS that the U.S. had imposed on them in 1964. And in 1974 and 1975, all the Latin American countries said, you know, the hell with this. And they started coming to Washington. Every single one of them, their representatives meeting with Henry Kissinger would say, you know, we don't want to restrict our trade and our diplomatic relations and our military relations with Cuba anymore just to serve your Cold War, you know, megalomania here. We're going to vote to lift these sanctions, the OAS sanctions against Cuba. And Kissinger used this kind of pressure he was under as kind of a bargaining chip to approach the Cubans. This is why he was prompted to reach out to Castro and say, well, the United States could support the lifting of these multilateral sanctions. What can we work out with you in return? And we'd even be willing to normalize relations. And he initiated using a secret courier, a Democratic Party official named Frank Mankiewicz, sending handwritten notes to Fidel Castro in the summer of 1974. He initiated a set of secret meetings that almost led, I think, to normalization of relations. It was quite a fascinating history. We might have actually ended up with normal relations many, many years earlier, but we've had to wait until now.
Well, and one of the things that angered Henry Kissinger, as you write, is when Cuba sent troops to Angola, that seemed to really quash whatever deal was in the works.
Well, it did. It's true. The Cubans decided that the independence of their own foreign policy in the Third World, and particularly on the African continent, was more important to them at that moment than arriving at normal relations. Of course, they pointed out to Kissinger when he objected to this that the United States had sent the CIA into Angola to support these militant forces that were trying to overthrow the incoming government of Agustin Neto that Cuba was supporting. If the United States could intervene there, why couldn't the Cubans intervene there? But this was part of Kissinger's effort at detente. He was trying to – what he wanted in return from Cuba was for them not to play a role in the geopolitical chessboard that he was kind of trying to arrange with the Soviets in the Third World. And here these pipsqueak, this pipsqueak, as he kept referring to Castro in his meetings in the Oval Office with Gerald Ford, was screwing up his grand plan for U.S. influence in Africa and helping the Soviets out with their influence in Africa. And how could he do that? And he eventually went into Ford and said, we're going to have to clobber the Cubans, but we might have to wait until after the 1976 elections. And Gerald Ford, according to the declassified secret memorandum of conversation with Kissinger that we obtained for the book, said, I agree. And then Kissinger actually drew up contingency plans for attacking Cuba, which we also obtained the declassification of and published in the book for the first time.
So don't anger Henry Kissinger, right?
Well, in the end, he couldn't implement those plans because Ford lost the 1976 mm-hmm. election to Jimmy Carter.
But obviously, as you mentioned earlier, Jimmy Carter sort of continuing these private or secret negotiations with Cuba. Also, Ronald Reagan, once we get to the 1980s, we see this happening with a president that was very much a Cold War warrior.
Well, Kissinger really had an idea of normalizing relations with Cuba, and Jimmy Carter kind of picked up where Kissinger left off, and he actually became the first president of the United States to order secretly his national security team to start the process of normalizing relations with the Cubans. Led to a series of secret meetings in countries like Mexico, in Cuernavaca in Mexico, in New York City, in Atlanta, and eventually even a face-to-face meeting between Carter's emissaries and Fidel Castro in Havana. In the end, the whole issue of Africa also kind of undermined Carter's efforts and the fact that he did not win a second election. Right before the election of 1980, he promised Fidel Castro that in the second term they would talk heart to heart about normalizing relations going forward if Castro ended the Mariel boat lift that was happening at that time, the fall of 1980. And Carter could not fulfill that commitment because, of course, he lost to Ronald Reagan. Mm-hmm. Ronald Reagan did not have the same agenda of normalizing relations with Cuba. In fact, Ronald Reagan put Cuba on the terrorism list because he was angry at Cuba for supporting revolution, not terrorism, but supporting revolution in Central America. He was, however, forced to negotiate with Cuba over immigration issues, and the first significant immigration accord between the United States and Cuba came under the Reagan administration in 1984.
So it's so interesting to look at both Republican and Democratic presidents largely carrying on this policy of trying to figure out how to normalize relations between these two countries.
Well, you have a series of presidents that actually thought about doing this, starting with John F. Kennedy himself. And I have to say that that's the chapter that's so interesting for me in the book. Kennedy was actually trying to set up a secret meeting with Fidel Castro between their emissaries to discuss improving relations. This is the president that had authorized the Bay of Pigs invasion, that had actually implemented the trade embargo that Barack Obama is now trying to lift today. This is the president under whom the CIA began the famous Operation Mongoose efforts. But he, at the end of his administration, was actually involved in secret diplomacy with Fidel Castro. He actually had an emissary sitting with Fidel Castro at the moment that Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas. And when the news came in and the two of them in Havana, the emissary and Fidel Castro were listening to the news of the death of the president, Castro said to Kennedy's representative, there goes your mission of peace. Mm. So the assassination undercut whatever momentum that was building in the early 60s. Kennedy looked at doing this seriously. Henry Kissinger and Gerald Ford looked at doing this seriously. Jimmy Carter probably was the most committed president before Barack Obama to normalize relations with Cuba. Clinton started working towards much better relations, and we tell in many details all the back and forth and ups and downs and crises and opportunities and progress that were made during his administration. But now it falls to Barack Obama to be the president who has made this history happen and changed the past so that the future can be better. And he will go down in history with that legacy, ending this Cold War era perpetual antagonism in U.S. policy towards Cuba and creating what he himself has called a new day, a new beginning in U.S.-Cuban relations.
Well, as we all know, the last couple of days, obviously not everyone is in favor or in support of what the president did on Wednesday. But do you think domestically, and this is obviously talking about the United States, and then I do want to talk about the region, but domestically politics have changed enough that it sort of opened the door for President Obama to make the announcement?
President Obama, when he was elected, he'd actually run on a campaign of sitting down and talking to Raul Castro and changing U.S. policy towards Cuba. And he did rather well in Florida when he first ran in 2008 and did even better when he ran in Florida 2 years ago for re-election. He one of the first things that he did, and he did it under pressure from the region, from Latin America, which has wanted to see better relations with Cuba for a long, long time for a variety of reasons. President Obama, in the very early in his presidency, he kind of opened the door to free travel for all Cuban Americans, not for all Americans, but for just Cuban Americans. And Cuban Americans were restricted under George Bush to only one visit every 3 years, and that they had to justify going to see an ill relative. And Barack Obama said, you know, Cuban Americans should be allowed to travel whenever they want, for as long as they want. And so you had all these people starting to go from Florida to visit their relatives in Havana. And progressively, they became invested in the change in economics in Cuba, in helping their relatives better their lives in Cuba, in visiting the island themselves. And that really helped kind of erase, change, evolve the kind of opinions of Cuban Americans in Florida to the point where the majority of Cuban Americans really do want to see better relations with Cuba, normal relations, free travel for everybody.
I'm interested, too, in the regional implications as well. And as you said, you know, most countries in the Americas have been allies of Cuba, sort of putting the United States by itself largely. Do you think President Obama also wanted to sort of reconnect the countries living in this part of the world?
When you look at the whole history of how this has played out, the United States kind of corralled all the Latin American countries in the 60s to try and oppose and undermine Cuba and isolate Cuba. It was a policy of isolation, it was called. And progressively, beginning in the early 70s, all these countries said, look, we're going to reestablish our relations with Cuba, and if you don't want to, you don't have to, but we are going to do that. And they did. And ever since, they've been pushing the United States to reestablish their own relations. And you've gone from a policy of trying to isolate Cuba to a reality in which it's the United States that is isolated. The United States is the one country in the whole region, if not the whole world, that doesn't have normal relations with Cuba. It makes absolutely no sense. And the turning point here was the Summit of the Americas that have been taking place since the early 1990s, every 3 years. And at the last Summit of the Americas in 2012, the Latin American countries and the presidents of all those countries said to Barack Obama, we are not coming to the next summit unless Cuba is included. So if you want to have a summit and you want us to attend, you have to stop your opposition to Cuba being invited. And in fact, the government of Panama, which is hosting the next summit in April of 2015, went ahead and invited Raul Castro to attend the summit for the first time since the summits started in 1994. And this is one of the reasons why you are seeing this announcement of this new policy now, because with the invitations having gone out to the summit and with Barack Obama trying to use his decision to go to the summit himself and see Raul Castro there in April, he wanted to add that to the list of things, list of initiatives that he was taking. And he had this window of time between now and April to essentially try and smooth the road to the summit and make it as productive as possible and make sure that Cuba and U.S. policy towards Cuba wasn't really the dominant thing on the agenda at the summit. And so by taking this initiative right now, these sweeping changes, he has completely changed the tenor and the character of what the next summit will be.
And isn't it, though, up to Congress, though, to officially lift the embargo? It looks like the president is sort of picking away at pieces of the embargo, but it's really up to Congress to sign off on either maintaining it or getting rid of it or amending it.
I mentioned earlier in our conversation that John F. Kennedy had imposed the embargo by presidential decree. And up until February of 1996 or March of 1996, when Bill Clinton signed the Helms-Burton bill, it was up to the president, the embargo. If the president wanted to lift the embargo, all he had to do was sign a decree lifting the embargo. Our book, Back Channel to Cuba, which I've done with William Leogrand, professor at American University, tells the detailed story of how President Clinton came to give away the embargo to Congress. And so that's no longer a presidential decree to lift the embargo. It has to be a vote of the majority of the Senate and the House to fully lift the embargo. And it's an amazing story worth reading. You're absolutely right. To fully lift the embargo, it's going to take a vote in Congress. Congress is now dominated by Republicans. That vote is not likely to come anytime soon. However, the law says that the president can waive all sorts of parts of the Helms-Burton bill, which codifies the embargo. And this is what Barack Obama is doing. He's using his presidential power to waive various elements and create holes in the embargo, broader licenses, general licenses for travel, so that many more of us can now go. Apparently, our travel is going to be on the honor system. We can just go. We're not supposed to be tourists there, but as long as that we can show that we fit under various educational kind of categories, we can go. And I think the vast majority of Americans who want to travel to Cuba will be able to fit into those categories. And then commerce, he's also using his presidential decrees to kind of expand trade with Cuba, even before Congress has voted to lift the embargo. And, you know, eventually the embargo will be like a dam with a lot of holes in it. The water will be pouring through and the dam will weaken and eventually give way. U.S. business interests want to get back into Cuba. Very wealthy Cuban Americans whose families had holdings in Cuba before the revolution are dying to go back and invest. And they all understand that Cuba's economy is changing from a socialist economy to a capitalist economy, and they want to be part of that change.
Well, Peter Kornbluh, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
I'm glad to talk to you on this momentous historic week of change in U.S. policy towards Cuba.
We're glad to have you, and he's co-author of a new book called Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. It's produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.